Thank you all for being here. So I'm also in the area of online learning, and I'm here to basically talk about FOI 247, which is Focus on Youth with Impact 24/7. It's online training that we developed, we're currently evaluating in a randomized controlled trial with funding from the National Institutes on Mental Health. Let's see. So briefly, I'll tell you why we're doing online training, what the key elements of the training were, specifically what the gamification elements are, and then what we're learning right now. We're still collecting data, but what we know right now about what the most useful elements of the training are. So, and this is a non-disclosure, this program I'm talking about is free online as a PDF, so we're not selling this product. But basically, I've been in the field, in the arena of training folks face-to-face or online to implement evidence-based intervention. So the idea is, if you have a program you know has worked or works, that we want to, it doesn't always work if people aren't doing it correctly. So we want to make sure that folks in the field have the skills, the knowledge, the right attitudes to lead it as it's supposed to be led to be effective. So this is the intervention. Sorry, it's fuzzy, but it's basically an intervention for 12 to 15-year-olds, primarily African-American, doesn't need to be African-American youth, and it's HIV prevention. The neat thing about this program, it's not only 8 sessions for youth, but each of the youth would, if it's done ideally, the facilitators lead a session with each youth and their parent or guardian. Of course, the youth are horrified by the idea, but they usually are happy after it's happened, if it happens. So basically for this study, we were working primarily with finding folks from the African-American communities, like I said, 12 to 15-year-olds. I basically covered this slide, except they also teach it with a co-facilitator, which is really different than a lot of other curricula out there. Before I move on, I want to say, as Hector mentioned, things change. Funding changes, trends changed. A lot has changed. When we first decided to do an online training on this program, DHAP, the CDC's Division of HIV and AIDS Prevention, couldn't really keep up with the demand for training on this curriculum, and they also had 5-day trainings, and not everyone could get in, and so we were having a lot of requests to do trainings for this program. Now it has been kind of de-emphasized, and DHAP has moved over to prevention for positives and not really doing primary prevention with teens anymore in the community. So it's really, when we were looking for folks to take part in this study, it was kind of hard to get all the folks who wanted to be part of it. All of a sudden, we're shifting to other areas where there was more money for them. So why online training? I just kind of explained, we were having requests for online training, and unlike schools where you have a big district and a lot of folks that need training and you can go out and do it in person, this was like really working with small pockets of people all over the country, rural areas. So doing something online made a lot more sense, and it could really reduce costs. And then it's not just that, but instructionally you can do so much with online training that really helps with face-to-face training, I don't think online training can ever really replace face-to-face, but there's things you can do with online training you can't do with face-to-face. Like in a face-to-face, you can model something and people can remember it, but online they can watch that model over and over, and it's distributive learning. They learn a little bit and can get it when they need it as they go. So that's important. A lot of reinforcement, and then they can get the follow-up support from a trainer online or from their coworkers or other facilitators that are using the training. So for the study we had, we got a lot more people than this, but right now what I'm going to be sharing is information from 53 people who gave us information on the training in 17 states and 91%. I forget what my 91, I thought I was being slick by not putting all the words on here. I'll remember what that is. 91% were African American, that's what that was. And I think we had 93% had some college. So before I get into the online training, I want to just mention the challenges. Even if you put together a really awesome online training, there are so many challenges at work, at home, and even if you manage to get the folks on the computer and they have it in front of them, they're still getting email pop-ups and Twitter feeds and all that. So we, knowing this and having done a couple other online trainings, we were really trying to do our best to compete with all these competitions and challenges for attention and engagement on in the trainings. So we worked with focus groups, and I'm going to move into key elements of the training, but basically this is a dashboard we developed, and you can see on the left is corresponding. We tell them how long each of the training sessions will take. The training sessions correspond with the sessions they'll be teaching. So and they have a date, a schedule. I don't know if you can see in the black little lines, it says the date that they're supposed to be teaching that lesson. So we're trying to help them track when they have to get it done. We'd learn on other trainings, they didn't start a training early enough, and they're like, oh, this took me more time than I thought. I couldn't get it done in the 20 minutes I left before I was, you know, working with the kids. So then we have an avatar woman in the front. When folks sign into the training, they can pick one of six, like just regular looking people in street clothes, and as they progress through the training, the street clothes move and change until they, at the end, they're a superhero. We have a community on the right, a help section on the bottom. You'll see more of these as we go through. So that's one element we're calling is just the dashboard. That's kind of the home base for the training. Then we basically had skills modules for each of the sessions they were teaching. So each of the eight sessions, youth sessions, and then the parent sessions. So it would bring them through in a pretty linear model and format. And then on the right, you can see there are two skills we focus on, engaging parents and leading role plays, where they actually got to see a bunch of videos and go through some interactions. So as far as the gamification elements, they could earn points on the left there. In the middle, they could see their co-facilitator's progress, because like, you know how kids, when they're playing games, they can see how everyone else is doing. I mean, not just kids play video games, but you can see how your opponents are doing. They unlock sessions, and then the avatars were the biggest part. In for other trainings we've done with teachers, they weren't so interested in gaming elements, but our focus group said that they were interested and it would make it more fun. That's what they said. It's not how it ended up. So then lots of videos for skill modeling, and we almost always with the videos would have an ineffective model first and then an effective model so that they could end on an effective model. And then we had your turn kind of interactions where we'd use video to help them do an assessment and practice the information. It kind of served both purposes. So like down below, like right here, there's five different videos here that they could click on and then have to answer questions about it just to process it and to learn it better. And then just right here, since my kid wasn't here, here is a picture of my son. Since everyone else got to bring their kid. So, and then we had, for all sections, there's resources all the way through, but there's one spot on the dashboard where we have all the resources listed. And as they go through the training and unlock sections of the training, all the resources would unlock. And this was a really, really long list of tip sheets and every video they saw, every little goodie they were given in the training. If they might be able to use it again, we listed it here for easy access. And then we had some mobile flashcards because we thought if they're going to be out in the community and folks home working with parents, and I mean the parent session they did was really super intense. They would go into the home, meet with a youth, you know, a 13-year-old and a parent or two parents. Maybe there's other kids running around, and they would basically go show an HIV video. They would talk about how HIV is transmitted. They would do a condom demonstration. They'd have the parents do a condom demonstration, and they would do a role play where about parents and teens talking about sex and parents monitoring their their youth's behavior. I mean, super intense stuff. So we wanted to give them as much information. And a lot of these, the workers are like young folks going into homes who don't have children. And so a lot of the parents, you know, were like, you don't even have a kid and you're telling me how to talk to my kid about sex. Like, so we gave them a lot of information, a lot of models. These are the kind of parents you're going to run to, like the parent who just tries to boss you around. And we tried to, you know, working with our focus groups, attend to all the kind of worst-case scenarios in their mind of what they might run into. So we did give them some mobile flashcards. So like right before they get in the house, when they're beginning ready to knock on the door, they could go over one more time, okay, how do I, you know, what do I do? So we thought that would be useful. Turns out it really wasn't. So here's everything we knew about training, we did a successful training, evidence-based training for teachers using a different one of our curricula. So we applied a lot of what we learned before, but it's so different. This population is so different. So what they liked the most, and this was, if they rated it as little useful, useful, or very useful, all those together, that's what this reflects. So the collection of resources was up there. They all felt that was useful. They organized by teaching schedule. We've never tried that before. They thought that was useful. They liked the training dashboard and the handouts and printable resources. That's also included in the collection of resources, so that's not really a surprise. And then the other three, and this is a little out of order, so I switched it, but it didn't. So the next one would be 90% said the your turn interactions. Then it was between the skills modeling and the links that we provided. So this was surprising to us because in the past the videos and the resources have always been the very highest things in our trainings, that they love the videos. If that's, you know, sometimes that's all they liked, but in this training it wasn't rated as highly. So those were the top things. I think part of why their videos weren't rated as highly is with this curriculum, people adapt it so much more. Like a lot of folks didn't want to do individual meetings with parents, so they would have a whole bunch of parents come together. Well, that means all the videos we put together for the individual intervention with parents didn't really apply. So the more they changed the curriculum or implementation, the less our videos applied. And I think that's maybe why they didn't like them as much. Because they were the same quality. Because what we've learned on past projects was it doesn't have to be stellar, super high-level, slick video. It needs to be good enough, if it's whatever that means. It needs to be, you know, you can see what's happening, you can hear what's happening, you can suggest this is a home or suggest it's a classroom. It doesn't have to be, you know, Hollywood kind of quality. So the avatars were less useful, even though we had 2/3 that found them useful to some degree. Some people just flat out did not like them. The avatars were stupid. I don't like them. Things like that. Someone's hiring us to possibly adapt the training, and the first thing they said is, can we take out the avatars? So that was definitely not hit the nail on the head. The discussion boards, they just were very poorly used, and the mobile flashcards, they rated them okay, but as far as using them, they were very, very poorly used. So I think that's all I have to share on that. So thank you for listening. I have some little flyers on the training if you're interested in learning more about it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Hi, this has been great. I'm a bad moderator. I sent around the attendance lists at the last minute, but they are making their way around. So it seems like we have time for questions for all the different presenters. So there is a mic over there that I can run around with, or if people could stand up and speak up, I think we'll do okay. So. Sure, especially, thank you, Gloria.
So I'll ask the first question.
Oh, all right, so you have the mic. I think there's a button that turns it on. I don't know, but there was.
They did something to it.
They did something to it, yeah.
It's on top.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Thank you. Okay.
Okay. So a quick question for Regina and then.
for Hector. Regina, in developing this training, did you have community health workers participate in that development of it? Okay.
Yes.
And then Hector, I know that you selected communities that were already using community health workers, but did you provide them with additional training to allow them to do some of the work, at high-level work?
Well, actually, the idea was that this was a five-year project. They were going to be engaged from the beginning in a transaction, not that we were only the ones that knew everything, but just to really begin to start engaging with them from the beginning and start really monitoring their progress, or their not their progress, but in some way their way of the experience among the different kinds of issues. So there are a lot of the community health workers were already from the community engaged in a lot of activities that were direct services, health education, and some of those kinds of components. So these other elements were new. However, the first year were engaged in all the time of bringing that opportunity for them to engage in some of the different elements of needs assessments, of getting the policy scan. And so there was a lot of interaction. And then themselves had, the community health workers were not alone. They were part of a team from the different regions that they had worked before, and so it became a very interactive kind of way.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
First of all, I wanted to say thank you to. I wanted to say thank you to all presenters. What a great presentation! And I just cannot think of a community health worker training without movement. I mean, applying the adult education principles, we know that we have to do activities, and we learn better when we do. So thank you. To Hector, I have something to say. I started hearing you present this, and this is great. This is it. We need community health educators. We need to empower them. We need to mobilize the community to really make real changes. And community health workers are great venues to do this. So I was very sad when you said no more funding, but at the same time, no surprise, because it's really, that project was really threatening the status quo. We are empowering community health workers to look at the community and, you know, pointing out what is missing, what we need to do. That would have meant, you know, really making many changes that were they, you know, feasible. I mean, I'm thinking about some communities here in Boston. That would mean make, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, McDonald's, I mean, those food deserts that we have. And once you become aware of something, how did you address? You think that the defunding of this project was related to that in some
part?
Well,
of course,
the
speakers
maybe go up there.
That's a great idea.
As you guys know, some of these programs, the sequestration and some of this led to cutting. As you know, we have been fighting cutting many of the food stamp programs and many of the programs that the communities really are in need, and they have been cut. So this was another one that actually the secretary just cut and found that perhaps in the future, but that there's just like right now money that need to be cut because there's no more money. And so I think, I don't know if you attended, I don't want to be too political, but if you attended, I do want to be political in for justice. I do want to be political for justice because I stand for justice. And so what Dr. Marmon mentioned about why are we in really in very low health and why we're so poor in health, well, here's the answer. Where are we putting the investments and what are we cutting? You know, that just speaks about where are we, that we had to really fight and that we couldn't win. And that all of a sudden say, well, maybe later you will bring it and then you all compete again. And so like, well, you know, this is how it works. the CDC still has it there because if you go to their website, the CDC was cut and it's been cut tremendously. And it was a 5-year or more than a half a million for each community. And so for 5 years to the opportunity, and so there were 70 communities, 70 the whole country or more that were affected by this. No, so it was an opportunity, but hopefully we'll continue and hopefully there will be more opportunities to learn that indeed when we move it to communities, They have the answers. We just have to give them the opportunity.
In Navajo Nation, we have an agreement with University of Arizona and our own tribal college. And so we have, we call our CHWs Community Health Representatives, and they take three core public health courses, and then they take one elective. And so they receive a certificate. The instruction is by the Nick College, but the certificate comes from University of Arizona. And once they're done with their certificate, we highly encourage our CHRs to go on and receive their AA. And then I have one that received her undergraduate degree and now pursuing a master's.
Thanks again for all the presentations. So I was wondering if you thought about pursuing funding from, like, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation or other private sources.
Well, I'm not sure that you guys are all involved in this issue about funding and not funding, and how hard it is to be constantly go and ask some of these foundations for help, no? All of us do that all the time, constantly. And it's hard because it really, it's not our priorities right now, and it's not in that infusion of funding. Doesn't get reflected right away. So it is a little bit challenging. We are in this predicament sometimes that the investments that we are doing in promotion, remember how much we invest in promotion in dollars or something? And so it is really hard. Yes, we try, but it's difficult to really infuse an element at a time when that perhaps is not in the radar screen. And I think as we know, it's like when you breastfeed a child, you know, you don't breastfeed, for example, if it's breastfeeding, you don't breastfeed a child today and tomorrow I'm breastfeeding the child, right? And the day after, that's how we treat prevention. That's enough. Let's just do something. So that's, think about it. That's how we think about prevention. It's completely intermittent, not an investment in our communities. No wonder we're 17 and 100 and below. We are very poorly run in health because some of these kinds of things, if they are related. So it is very difficult that sometimes we have to think that our community health workers, because how many of us have got grants, and all of a sudden we have to say, thank you so much for being with us 5 years. You were wonderful. Adios. You know? And so the people just say, well, why? I don't have any job now. Well, you know, we don't have any more money. We tried, but we couldn't compete. Because right now, it's so hard, the competition, that the community health workers is no longer innovative. And got to the NIH, that's no longer innovative. Yes, sure, it's no longer innovative, but it works. Okay, you want to invest in it or not. You have to prove that it's innovation, or you have to prove that it is a function for the real prevention that we can learn from it.
Hi, this is Anna, and I'm coming from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and thank you for all the presenters, and I wanted to ask Hector, this project is really music to my ears. We have been doing the same exact thing in Milwaukee, Wisconsin with the smaller scale project, and I'm very proud to see exactly the same steps that we did in a very grassroots way with the health workers. Are you guys taking another state, even without funding?
Well, it's really interesting because I guess we wish that in many ways, yes, it should be an element of learning, but then it's hard when sometimes there's no funding involved, and so then your community health workers and some of your investment is not really able to provide the sequence of approaches that are required. But what is really interesting about what you said is one thing, is that really there is no magic to prevention. It's simplicity. There's a lot of things that are very simple. You guided the same model because you believe in the same model. So we have to do those things. So it is simplicity about finding who is going to really help in prevention. So I think it's wonderful that you said that you use the same model. I'm sure that many of you have used very similar models. And they work, right? They work in your communities in many functions. So I hope that the community, I mean, a lot lot of the people here in many states are trying to do communities of learning with community health workers, and the work in Massachusetts, in New York, and all of you guys that do so much work in Texas and many places. But the community of learning, of prevention, sometimes is hard because of the fact that that cohesiveness, because what happens, I don't have too much money to feed my family, so I need to find some other way of, so a lot of the altruism of our community sometimes gets not possible because they cannot continue, no?
Thank you. I think there's another question.
Oh.
So, like, the
thank you very much.
I have a question, it's for Regina and Katie. In your efforts to work with parent-child dyads, and I guess you guys are like a living example of this, but can you talk a little bit about, like, were the interactions limited to a disease concept, or did those CHWs actually go in there to improve that relationship? You're not an ideal model of relationship. We don't always see parent-child relationships that are quite that nurturing. And so did your program try to address that and improve that situation, or was it just disease?
So the impact component of FOI, or Focus on Youth, with impact is informing parents and children together. And the idea was parental monitoring, that the more parents know about what's happening with their youth and the more they talk about what's going on with them, that the youth would be healthier. So it was an HIV prevention program, but they did, so it did come out of that, I think it came out of that model. I mean, the developer was Bonnie Stanton out of Baltimore. But they do know that not only did it decrease sexual risk-taking behavior, it decreased drug and alcohol and cigarette use and other substances, and it reduced carrying weapons and reduced violence. So it did make them all around healthier. But did it come out of a disease prevention model? I think it did. Oh, definitely, definitely. Because just going into it, some of the best from our participants in the study, some of the best things we've heard from them is they felt like they really helped these families, that they didn't want to lead the impact sessions. It was scary. It felt like they were, you know, going into people's homes and messing with their family dynamics, but they felt like it was, for them as community youth workers, like it was like the best part of the program for them, that they felt like it really helped the families. And we did get postcards from all the parents involved, and every single postcard said it was a very valuable experience for them to be part of it.
Which may be just a different spin on what you're saying, but community health aides and community health practitioners in Alaska now with the Affordable Care Act is something that could be available for other communities to look at. And so I would invite you to explore the Community Health Aid Program website in the fact that they are the medical providers in their communities, and they their scope of practice, they're eligible for Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement. And I think that as we support and empower and provide education for our community health aides and community health practitioners, that we're seeing multi-generational community health workers then. So now I work at the training center in Anchorage, and we now have kids of kids of kids who have been the traditional healers in their communities. You know, and so I think that's a whole nother spin on how we support families in these health professions.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions for our presenters? Well, thank you very much, all of you. This was just a very interesting, diverse, and rich for a program. I wanted to remind everyone that there are two concurrent community health worker poster sessions in the conference center right now, 4:30 to 5:30, and then the community health worker section, we have our social reception here back in this building in the Lewis Room at 6:30, and I hope you can all make all of them. Thanks.